coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The use of telehealth is exploding during the COVID-19 pandemic.
We have had for so many years the codes available to use for telehealth, and they just weren't being taken advantage of.
We talked to Highmark Senior Medical Director Dr. Timothy Law about what the shift to telehealth means now and in the future. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine ways the business community believes state government can help an economic rebound from the pandemic and learn about changes coming to the historic John Dickinson plantation. And Enlighten Me features stories from student journalists at the University of Delaware. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As one might expect, digital doctor visits exploded over the past year during the COVID-19 pandemic. Claims data from Highmark Blue Cross Blue Shield Delaware shows the use of telehealth services among its members jumped 2,700% in 2020. Delaware Public Media's Nick Schlino recently spoke to Highmark Senior Medical Director Dr. Timothy Law about why, in some respects, this is a good thing and what this may mean for the medical industry going forward.
So I've been a telehealth proponent for probably 2 decades since I was in the military and did this kind of work, and have been lecturing about it all over the world, actually, about telehealth for years prior to the pandemic. And now that we see this pandemic hit, it's been actually that part of it has been nice that it's been available for our members and our providers to continue business, our members to still get the care that they need in a timely fashion. So we were quite ecstatic about looking at the numbers. You see January and February of last year at their normal levels, maybe 1,000 or so per month. And then March, it started to go up to probably 10 times that at 11,000. And then by April, it was pushing upwards of the 40,000 visits per month. So it was expected, I think, but I think better than expected.
So it looks like you view this as a sort of silver lining to the pandemic. Were we headed in this direction already, and then the pandemic just sort of accelerated our move to telehealth?
No, I think not, actually. As I stated, we have had for so many years the codes available to use for telehealth, and they just weren't being taken advantage of. I think that doctor-patient interaction in person, sort of getting in front of somebody just really was never sought to be replaced, except in rare circumstances, rural medicine, inability to leave the home and things like that. So it was still being used, but just not as much as it maybe could have been. But I think now that it was forced upon us, similar to, your everyday business meetings, how many businesses before this thought that you could have your whole workforce working from home and still operate, a business effectively? Same situation goes for our doctors. So you need it. The problem with this was you needed 2 people to buy into it, right? You needed the 3 actually. You needed the providers themselves, the physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, to buy into it that, yes, we could still deliver some good quality medical care this way. And 2, you needed the members, the patients, to buy into it and say, yeah, I can still see my doctor. I can still tell him what's going on. I can show him some of the things that are going on. And then 3, you needed the payer organization to say, yeah, this is a legitimate way to handle things and happy to do it. So, yeah.
So what are the benefits of telehealth as opposed to in-person doctor visits under certain circumstances?
Yeah, so I think one of the main things that we found from our data was that of all the visits we had, 3.3 million of telehealth claims were for local doctors, and only about 79,000 were to our vendors like Teladoc, Brightheart, American Well, Doctor on Demand, those kind of entities. And I think what that shows is people still wanted to see their own physician. And the literature would show that telehealth works best when it's by someone that's familiar with your case already. not that you can't do it in other settings, but if a patient already has a doctor-patient relationship and now they're calling in, you know, have an issue that comes up, it's much easier and I think more productive if the person on the other end of the phone knows you, knows of you, has access to your chart and your medical history. So that part of it has been great. You know, it still hasn't solved all the problems, obviously. There's still the in-person stuff that you can't do over the phone. You can't do, for instance, a vaccine over the phone. You know, we haven't come up with that technology yet. So things that have to be administered in a fashion that involves more invasive techniques, that stuff can't be done. But what it can do is do the preliminary part of that exam, for instance. You know, in pediatric patients, you can still have the mother and child or the father and child there and go over some anticipatory guidance. What kind of milestones have they met? Let's see them roll over. Let's see them babble. Let's hear them babble. Do that kind of stuff. Do you have a rash? You know, how's their arms and legs moving? All that kind of stuff. You can do that. And so you get to keep that part of the interaction going. And then, of course, you talk about your elderly. You know, what is it? 80% of those that have succumbed to COVID-19 were over 65. And so those people are way more risk by going out in public to a physician's office where you expect there to be more sick people, you know, hospitals and doctor's offices. That's where people go when they're sick anyway. And so you don't want them to come out if they don't have to. And if you can do some of that stuff over telemedicine, that's much better. Even CMS for Medicare came out early on in the pandemic and said, listen, for our annual wellness visits, you know, in addition to a blood pressure and a height and weight, the rest of it was all talking to the patient, right? Giving them anticipatory guidance about what screening tests were coming up, what are they lacking in their historical data of what needs to be done for blood testing, et cetera. And you can do all that over the phone. So they said, well, you know, go ahead and do those annual visits. We don't want people to miss that kind of that part of their care because it's so important to be proactive on health problems as opposed to reactive. You know, let's not wait till someone gets something to treat it. Let's be available to do that, but let's try to get in there before it starts. So I think for those two populations, it's been really, really good.
According to the data, it shows that behavioral health has been the largest area where this has been used. Can you talk about what it's meant for that area of medicine?
Well, I'll tell you, it's one of those kind of things where you would almost call it priceless, really. The increase in behavioral health services, and I think not just with Highmark, but in general, has been an 8,000-fold increase. And as you know, here in what's going on in society with the lockdowns and various, fear of the unknown and this virus, et cetera, and lack of interaction with other people, you know, mental health issues have really come to the forefront. So you have that part of it. So there's more people that may have an issue that's coming to a head because of the circumstances around them. But you also have this issue of the stigma that may still be attached to behavioral health services. So we have found that oftentimes, a large percentage of the people utilizing telehealth for behavioral health have not even been in the system before in the behavioral health world, but now have found it more a little bit easier to come into the system because they can stay at home and do it. They don't have to go and sign in front of somebody and have other people see them in that particular doctor's office or take off work. You know, they're already working from home, for instance, so they could take a lunch break and a half hour lunch break and see their provider. We've even expanded it to include things like partial hospitalization and intensive outpatient therapy for psychiatric care. So when people are leaving the hospital, there's often these kind of step down units where they would normally leave the hospital from acute inpatient psychiatric stay and have to go to these, they would get to sleep at home, but maybe come to a facility for 8 hours a day to watch over them. Maybe it's an eating disorder or some other thing, but they need various modalities during the day. We have found that in talking with our provider networks, at first we wouldn't think this was doable, but once the provider networks are calling us, say, listen, we have a plan to do this. Help us. And so then we got into that. And so we're also using that part of it. So I think it has been a really a good boon for the behavioral health industry. I think that will stick. And I think the numbers have shown that is sticking more than, say, the regular primary care kind of visits have. And so as primary care kind of went back down to not normal, but lower than it was during the height of the pandemic, behavioral health also went down a little bit, but it stayed up much higher, closer to where it peaked at, back in April and May of last year.
And that leads into my next question. Given all the benefits that you've mentioned about telehealth, do you think that it's here to stay, at least in some way?
Yeah, I think in some way it is here to stay. We'll find out. Remember that there is a little bit of a skew point here, and that is that during the pandemic, companies, Highmark, for instance, as well as many others, I think, have waived cost sharing for telehealth services in network during that. And I think we've extended that to March 31st at this point. And so think about that. If you don't have to pay a copay, for instance, or pay a deductible and all that kind of stuff, and you can still get your services at home, you may be a little bit more apt to do that than if you have to pay your whatever, $15, whatever dollar copay you happen to have, some monetary value. You might, we'll find out, we don't know yet. You might then at that point say, well, if I'm going to pay my $20, I want to see them in person kind of thing. We'll find that out later. But in some way, shape, or form, it's here to stay. I think more so in the behavioral health field than anything else, but I think it'll be across the board. Doctors that have put the time, effort into developing a program that allows them to do telehealth wasn't a small feat by any stretch of the imagination, but humans are by nature very adaptive, and there's been some remarkable heroic changes made across the industry, and I think those that have put that much time and effort into it will in some way use that as another component of their delivery of healthcare.
Thanks to Highmark Senior Medical Director Dr. Timothy Law and our Nick Schellino for their time on The Green this week. The Green continues in a moment with more on how the business community believes the first state can best rebound from the damage done by the pandemic. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. There is good news for the first state when it comes to COVID-19. Cases and hospitalizations are trending down, and Friday, Governor Carney loosened restrictions on businesses, restaurants, and indoor gatherings, allowing up to 50% capacity now. But even if things continue in the right direction, plenty of work remains to rebuild many sectors of the state economy shattered by the pandemic. Business leaders are weighing in on how they believe the state should put the pieces back together, offering a road to recovery roadmap to Governor Carney and lawmakers as they build their 2022 budget. Contributor John Hurdle took a look at their recommendations and the state's response in his latest piece available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to discuss what he found. So let's start with the groups that are offering this road to recovery, as they call it. Who is that exactly laying out this set of recommendations that you're reporting on, and what are they hoping to accomplish with it?
This is the Delaware State Chamber of Commerce and the Delaware Business Roundtable, and they've jointly put out the road to recovery, putting Delaware back to work. And that came out like a day or two before Governor Carney's budget. And their objectives here are firstly to repair the economic damage done by the pandemic. Of course, we all know that job losses have been pretty harrowing. And so the business groups are looking for ways to address that issue. And at the same time, they're looking to fix some long-term problems, things which existed before the pandemic, which they say are holding the Delaware economy back.
So one thing that we have reported on, and many, including Governor Carney, have touted, is Delaware's relative fiscal health a year after this pandemic started. The state does not face a deficit. It actually has some revenue to work with beyond just maintaining the status quo in the budget. How much does that factor into what the business community believes can be done to get the economy back on track?
Well, I think it's seen as being a very fortunate position that the state is in. We're currently looking at a budget surplus by the end of the year of about $495 million. That's expected to carry over into fiscal 2022. And that will create some room for spending on the business group's wish list items. And one of those is more childcare. I mean, as we know, many childcare facilities have been forced to close during the pandemic because of social distancing needs, and so the business groups are hoping that the state is going to step up and provide some assistance to kind of restore the number of childcare facilities. They're also looking for some help opening up lab space in the growing bioscience industry. I mean, that industry is seen as having some of the greatest potential to boost the state's economy, and so the business groups are looking for some state help as far as that's concerned. And the other point to bear in mind here is that that they're saying very clearly and very forcefully that there is no reason, given this budget surplus, there is no reason for any increase in taxes on either individuals or businesses. They feel that that would be damaging economically, especially in the current fragile situation.
So let's talk about some other specific recommendations from this group. One that we've heard before and appears again here is this idea of streamlining the permitting process for businesses that are trying to get things accomplished. What are they suggesting the state do here, and why?
Well, one of the ideas that the business groups are very emphatic about is this idea of ready in six. And what that means is that they're proposing that state agencies should be in a position to provide all the necessary permits for businesses setting up in Delaware within 6 months. And so this is something the business community has been quite concerned about for some time, and they say that that some agencies take up to 12 or even 18 months to provide all the necessary approvals. They focus specifically on DelDOT and DENREC and say that that there is some progress has been made as far as DelDOT's concerned, but the business community is saying that that DENREC in particular is kind of slow in its issuance of permits, and they fear is actually holding back the economy. And in terms of implementing this Ready in Six initiative, they're proposing that the state hire a so-called concierge who would kind of drive this permit streamlining process and report directly to the governor.
There's also a fair amount of attention paid to dealing with those who've lost their jobs during the pandemic. We've already seen lawmakers pass and Governor Carney sign legislation providing some immediate relief by waiving state taxes on unemployment benefits paid last year. But unemployment remains a persistent issue. It's gotten better, but it's still much higher than it was pre-pandemic. How bad are things at this point still, and what issues remain that these groups feel can be addressed by the state?
Well, the latest data that we've had from the Department of Labor on unemployment is for the month of December, and what it shows is unemployment, the official rate was 5.3%. That's a lot lower than it was during its peak in the pandemic of around about 15%, but it's still a fair bit higher than the rate of approximately 3.5% that the state saw before the pandemic. So essentially, in terms of the official data, the employment situation doesn't look too bad. It's obviously a lot better than it was 6 months ago. The problem is that the official rate doesn't include part-timers, and it doesn't include others who have stopped looking for work during the pandemic. Perhaps they've become discouraged by the sudden lack of jobs. And so according to one economist at the University of Delaware that I've spoken with, the true unemployment rate is actually around about 11%. there's some interesting context there to, you know, a way of looking at these official numbers. Now, in terms of the issues, one of the issues in terms of getting more people back to work, we'll look at the how different industries are going to respond to the post-pandemic economy, and one of those industries, of course, will be retail. And there's a question of how many brick and mortar stores are going to reopen, and to what extent people are will continue to make their purchases online.
At one path they also talk about in trying to help people get back into the workforce is retraining. What are they proposing in terms of retraining and making that maybe a bit more accessible to people?
Well, the focus of the state's retraining initiative is something called Forward Delaware. It's a Department of Labor program that's funded by the Federal CARES Act. And it offers rapid retraining in five areas that are seen to have the greatest economic potential for the state. And those are IT, logistics, hospitality, construction, and healthcare. And the idea is that folks who've permanently lost their jobs and are being forced to sort of perhaps change their careers can work towards certificates that will give them some competency in whatever their chosen field is, and that these courses will be free. Now, I spoke to one young woman in Dover who was just nearing the end of a 6-week course as a certified nursing assistant, and she was very happy about that because she'd got laid off from her job as an Amazon warehouse worker and was already considering embarking on a career as a nursing assistant. And so she used that retraining program at Deltek to do that.
So what's the response been from the Carney administration? Do some of these things fit better with what we know about what the governor wants to prioritize in his budget?
Well, he does appear to have taken on board the business community's call for a streamline in permitting. The governor recently said that the issue is being examined by something called the Government Efficiency and Accountability Review. It's a bit of a mouthful there, but that's shortened to GEAR. And so it would appear that this is that this call by the business community is being taken seriously. The governor said that if businesses want to move into Delaware, then we need to have sites that are ready to go.
And finally, I guess, how much of this feels like a direct response to the pandemic and the damage it's caused? And how much are kind of these economic development ideas we've heard pre-pandemic that people are hoping will get a second look as part of this effort to rebound that might get a little bit more momentum because of that?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, we've seen obviously huge rises in unemployment, even though the numbers are coming back now. We know that sectors like restaurants, for example, have been really hard hit. And so I think job one for the business community is finding jobs for all those folks who've lost their jobs during the pandemic because of all the state mandated closures, but they're using this as an opportunity to address long-standing grievances such as the permitting delays that they feel have been and continue to hold back the state's economy, and they feel that this is a moment when that issue and those long-term issues can legitimately be addressed.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. His piece on the effort to bring Delaware's economy back after COVID-19 is available at DelawarePublic.org. Next, we look at changes coming to the historic John Dickinson Plantation in Kent County and how they'll work to tell a more complete story about the site and those who live there. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thank you. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Changes are coming to the John Dickinson Plantation in Kent County. The Delaware Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs master plan for the site calls for a new visitor center and more sections of the property to be open to the public. Dan Citron is a historic site team manager with the division. He says in addition to highlighting founding father John Dickinson's life, the plantation seeks to tell the stories of others who lived there, including enslaved black men, women, and children. Citron recently spoke to Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about the plan changes and how they'll help offer a more complete picture of the site's history.
Give us some insight. Talk about the history of the John Dickinson Plantation.
Sure. Well, the land was expanded over time by the Dickinson family. It was originally purchased by John Dickinson's father, and so he moved there as a boy from Maryland. And ultimately, he and his brother inherited the land, and the John Dickinson Plantation, the area that John owned, grew to be about 5,000 acres over time. We don't have 5,000 acres there. We have just under 450 acres. And so if people are familiar with our neighbor just to the east, that is the St. Jones Reserve, all of that area would have originally been part of the plantation. So all the way over to Route 1 and then basically all the way over to the Delaware River. So it was a very large area, and we have a portion of it. John Dickinson spoke very passionately and wrote very passionately for American independence, although he had a little bit of a dichotomy there because he didn't think it was time to split from the British, so he lost some favor there, although ultimately, once that decision was made, he did decide to go ahead and enlist, and he did fight in the Revolutionary War. He was a very popular figure in his day, and he ended up becoming one of the early governors of Delaware, although he didn't stay governor of Delaware for all that long because then Pennsylvania invited him to be the governor of Pennsylvania. And so he left Delaware and went up to Pennsylvania and became the governor up there. We call this his boyhood home because he did live here as a boy and as a young man. He went to London to train to be a lawyer. And when he came back, he did visit this area from time to time, but a lot of his adult life was spent living in and around the Philadelphia area.
That's an interesting story in of itself, that he was governor of Delaware and he left to become governor of Pennsylvania. That's a story in itself, right?
It is. There are not many people. I'm not sure if there are any other people that were governor of two states. And he was very well regarded here in Delaware, even though he didn't really live here. Like I said, most of his adult life, he was not living here in Delaware, but he was still well regarded in the area, and people really looked up to him. And so he was elected, and he had served other elected posts in Delaware, and he did receive that. He did accept it, but it wasn't for too long because he was also well regarded in Philadelphia. So he went up there and he became the governor. And, you know, people in Delaware maybe weren't too happy about it, but obviously his legacy here in Delaware lives on, so everybody was able to get over it.
Dan, how many people were enslaved on the site of the John Dickinson Plantation?
We're still working on an exact number. Part of the issue with researching people who were enslaved is that their history has been erased, and that is true for any site like this. It is always difficult to be able to say with absolute certainty that we've been able to track down the lives of every single person who were there, just because records were not kept on enslaved individuals by everybody. They weren't always counted in census records as they should have been. And so it is just very, very difficult to be sure. Now, we do have manumission documents, and so those are documents used to free enslaved people from John Dickinson. There's a few of them where he manumitted a few people or a group of people, but in some cases they would be free after 20 years more labor or something like that. Ultimately, he did end up freeing everyone who he enslaved, and so there are, I believe, just over 40 names on that list. But even he wanted to make sure he wasn't missing anybody, because at the end of that list, he actually notes, "and anyone else who I may have forgotten." or something to that effect. So even he recognized the fact that these lives and the recording of these lives was lost, even in the moment. So it is, we are trying to piece all of that together. And we do tell the stories of some of the enslaved people that we know on the site, and we are striving to learn even more.
Are there anyone, can we mention some of the names, maybe a more famous person on that site?
As far as enslaved people, you mean?
Yes.
So one of the people that we know a decent amount about, her name is Dinah. And she was enslaved on the plantation. She was ultimately freed. And the manumission document that frees her is in Delaware Public Archives. So we do have a copy of that as well. She ended up marrying a free black man who was a tenant farmer on the site. And so after she gained her freedom, she actually continued living there on the plantation as a tenant farmer herself. And so we do know a fair amount about her. She's mentioned a few times, and then she's listed in some of the tenant contracts with her husband.
All right, just to bring everyone up to speed, we're talking to Dan Citrin. Dan is a historic site team manager at the Delaware Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs. We're talking about the John Dickinson Plantation, and now that we've heard the history from Dan, want to move forward a little bit as part of an extensive master plan for enhancing and expanding the visitor experience at the John Dickinson Plantation, which is in Kent County in Dover. The Delaware Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs will be creating an area of reflection to allow visitors a quiet place for contemplation after learning more about the lives of those enslaved at the site. Talk about this.
Certainly. We're very excited about the work we're doing out there. Right now we have what we call the Historic Core, and that's the John Dickinson Mansion, which is a National Historic Landmark. And the area surrounding it, and what happened years ago was we reconstructed some of the agricultural outbuildings, as well as one example of what we call it a logged dwelling. Even though it's not made out of logs, that was a period term for it. It's a wood frame, wood-sided structure. It has no floor. There's a door on either side. It's just one room. And it's really representative of what a lot of people in Kent County would have been living in. The John Dickinson Mansion is a much larger structure. It's made out of brick. It represents what the extremely wealthy would have been living in. So a lot of people, when they see these old houses, they think, oh, this is what everybody was living in, and you know, wasn't this time beautiful? And what a lot of people don't realize is those houses survived because they were the best examples from the wealthiest individuals in that area. So the logged dwelling really does represent what most of the population of Kent County would have been living in. Some lived in something not quite as nice. Some lived in something a little bit nicer. This building also represents what the enslaved people would have been living in because these dwellings were scattered throughout the property where people were working. And so for the tenant farmers, they would have had it on the land they were renting. For the enslaved individuals, they would have had them fairly close to the fields they would have been working on, or if they were working in or around the mansion, their dwelling probably would have been closer to the mansion. And so we interpret these areas and talk about the lives of all of the people who lived at the John Dickinson Plantation. With this master plan, we're going to be building a new visitor center, a much larger visitor center, and it's going to have a large exhibit space. Our current visitor center has a small exhibit space that is also our sort of orientation space and a program space and a meeting space. This new visitor center will have all of those separated out so we can better meet the needs of all of our visitors, and we can have larger school groups and community groups can come in and use the meeting space. So we want it to be a community spot as well as a historic site. Coming out of the visitor center, we're going to have a variety of pathways that explore deeper into the property. So right now, a lot of the property is still used for agriculture, just as it was in John Dickinson's time, although it's modern agriculture. We're going to be taking some of that out of modern agriculture and part of the time we're going to be doing an archaeological field lab. So we'll have public archaeological programs. And then ultimately, we hope to be planting the types of things that we know from John Dickinson's writings were being grown on that land so that we can demonstrate the types of crops that were grown in the time period. These pathways will get people out into the property, into much more of it, going all the way down to the marsh of the St. Jones River and ultimately connecting us with our neighbors, the St. Jones Reserve, so people would be able to then utilize their trail system as well. And this will really not just get people out into the agricultural fields, get them out into nature and out to the marsh, but really get a better perspective of what life was like on this land, because our interpretation and our programming that's going to go along with this is going to be talking about who would have been living out on these areas, who would have been working out in these fields. While we already talk about the people who were enslaved at the John Dickinson plantation, this will be a more well-rounded experience so people get a better sense of what life was like out there during that time period.
Dan, how long before all of this is completed, and at what kind of a price tag?
We are still evaluating that. We are in the early stages of that part of it, so we're still at the conceptual design, and we're working on getting pricing, and so I can't really answer that part of the question yet, but it's going to be a multi-year project. We are working on finalizing some aspects to do some of the archaeology, because before we put any pathways down, since we would be disturbing the ground to do that, we want to make sure that we're protecting any buried cultural resources. We don't think there's, people hear that and they go, ooh, there's buried treasure out there. And it might be buried treasure to us as historians and archaeologists, but we're not expecting to find, a chest full of gold or anything like that. What we want to find are artifacts that talk about the life of the people who lived out there. So we want to make sure we're protecting all of those resources and we're finding out all of that information that we can. Then the pathways will go out on top of that where we've checked those areas. And so that'll be happening probably in the next 2 years and with the visitor center to follow.
All right. We can say that the project will be supported in part by a $5,000 grant from the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
That is correct. We are happy to receive a generous grant from the National Trust, and they are funding a program that we are doing jointly with the University of Delaware's landscape architecture program. We wanted to, as part of this master plan, incorporate an area of reflection, because we understand that the topics that we're covering, especially the lives of the people who were enslaved at the site, are very difficult. And they're not just difficult for visitors, they're difficult for us. And, you know, we understand we've had training, our staff has had training and done the research to be presenting this information. And even then, they are still difficult topics, and it can be quite upsetting. So we want to make sure that people have a quiet, appropriate reflective space on the property so that they can process the information that they've heard and think about it and reflect on it however they see fit. We don't dictate to people how they should feel about it, but we want to make sure they have a space to relax and reflect so that they can think about everything that we're presenting to them.
Thanks to Delaware Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs Historic Site Team Manager Dan Citron and our Kelly Steele for their time on The Green this week. We wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we spotlight more student journalism from the University of Delaware. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Recently, we've taken time to highlight work created by student journalists at both the high school and college levels. This time, we return to the University of Delaware, where despite the challenges created by the COVID-19 pandemic, students continue to do their work telling stories about issues and topics they find interesting and important. For this week's Enlighten Me, we highlight more pieces produced by UD Communications students for a class taught by Nancy Karabjanian, longtime First Day journalist, director of UD's Center for Political Communication, and one of the founders of Delaware Public Media. We start with junior communications major Anthony Dolphin. The Blue Hen football team is back on the field this month, practicing for a spring football season that starts March 6th. It's a season the team hopes will help replace what it and its fans missed out on last fall. And Anthony takes a look at the road to this unusual season.
For the Blue Hen community and many other colleges, that sound has been missing for quite some time now. UD football announced in the summer that there would be no football season coming fall. What was the school going to do? How were they going to do it?
First and foremost, what was going to happen with the season training camp, because I had a lot of things pre-booked that I knew that I would have to delete or, cancel.
That's Carl Kotz, the director of operations for the UD football team. The sudden cancellation of the fall schedule caused huge headaches for him, but there were greater problems at stake.
Okay, are the kids okay, or do they have a safe place to stay? Are they, are they home? Are they here in their apartment where everybody is, kind of keeping track of that? And then, trying to make sure the guys were set for finishing finals, that they were keeping in touch with academics.
Zoom became a lifeline for Carl and the team. Not always easy for him with a three-year-old at home, but in person, training camp starts back up in January.
You're in a training camp in January where everything's going to be freezing. So that's going to be interesting to see how that goes.
It's going to be really interesting, especially we're lucky. We don't go up to Maine. Maine's coming down here.
Other than players and coaches, the loss of fall football was hard for those in the broadcast booth, like Scott Klatskin.
There was a lot of anxiety that came about of anticipating what could be. There was a lot of conversating with other people. What have you heard? And what have you heard? And just trying to get an idea of what might happen in the fall. But it was an anxious time.
Klatskin is the play-by-play caller for UD football from WSDW.
They're doing everything in their everything possible to make sure that everyone is as safe as possible, that they come through those doors, and that the player safety is number one and the staff safety is number one.
How could the heart and soul of UD feel about all this? What do the fans think? Feeling left out of the equation is the fans. Scott Strychars is a lifelong supporter and season ticket holder.
You know, them not playing, I understand the safety of the students and the athletes and everyone involved, most importantly, the fans too. But I, probably what you're getting is I'm not 100% happy with the way the athletic department has handled.
There was only a few options given to season ticket holders. Donate your money, keep it for next year, or get a refund. There's one thing that can be said for all levels of UD football. Excitement is here for the spring season.
I am excited.
I couldn't be more excited.
I do see a lot of promise.
I'm Anthony Dolphin, reporting UD News.
Thanks to junior communications major Anthony Dolphin for his reporting. Next up, we hear from senior communications major Kayla Williams. She says with the pandemic limiting what people can do at schools, bars, and churches, people have shifted their lives to fit the new normal. And that means indulging in some new interests.
With the new normal, people have been at home for a while. But once you've watched everything on Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime, what else is there to do? Several people took this time to pick up new hobbies that have now become a lifestyle.
I was complaining to Kenya, my daughter. I said, I don't have anything to do. I've done everything I can possibly do. And she said, why don't you pick up your bass that's sitting in your man cave and learn how to play it?
Rick Gallion is a retired 70-year-old man who picked up playing the guitar in the earlier months of the pandemic.
I ordered a DVD and a book. And I started doing online instructions. And I've been playing with my bass every day. During my downtime, after my nap, I usually get on my bass and do bass lessons every day.
And Rick isn't alone. For some, it's music. For others, it's getting outside the house. Lovely Lacey got a bike in April. And 7 months later, riding is a part of her life.
I think it's helped me not just keep my sanity, but feel good about myself. I do believe that our bodies need movement. So it was allowing me to move and be active without having some sort of goal associated with it. So it felt very freeing.
For Rick, music went from hobby to passion.
yes, I will continue to do this. So, and I'm thinking all the time about different notes and things that I'm learning.
The new normal translated into a new talent for one, and a new lifestyle for Lovely.
Now it feels like something that is less a part of like my COVID routine and more just a part of my life routine.
Kayla Williams for UD News.
Thanks to Senior Communications Major Kayla Williams. And we finish with another UD Senior Comm Major, Alexa Corfine, who reports healthcare workers have shown remarkable resilience and professional dedication despite a fear of becoming infected by COVID-19 and infecting others.
This pandemic has thrown a scary curveball for healthcare workers all over the country. For doctors, specialties are being switched around to multiply the need for COVID assistance. Anesthesiology resident Jessica Vitas at Philadelphia's University of Pennsylvania Hospital found herself thrown into COVID care.
It was very scary at first because we didn't know what was going on and what was the safest for us, besides even what's the safest for the patients. So it was pretty confusing, and day by day we would get different guidelines on what to do. So it was definitely a stressful time at first.
Doctors like Jessica find themselves grappling with new hospital restrictions for protective equipment. Doctors are gearing up with what they have, and at times their specialties have had to shift due to the immense number of COVID patients.
We definitely we're definitely wearing more protective gear now when we intubate even negative people, which is a big change. More careful in general. And then anesthesiologists in general are trained also in critical care. So we've been pulled to do a lot more ICU time than we normally do. So that's a big change, that we're pretty heavy now in the critical care units.
From a heavy demand in critical care to a drop in ER visits as patients fear getting the virus just by visiting a hospital, Jeff Hensenberg is an orthopedic surgery resident at Thomas Jefferson Hospital.
For us, COVID's a bit different in that we don't treat patients for COVID, but we have to worry about safely doing surgery in patients that hurt themselves that have COVID. We don't do elective procedures, so a lot of times patients go long periods of time in pain because we don't want to expose them to the virus. And we also are being asked to help out in areas of the hospital that maybe normally we don't normally work in, like the emergency department.
Increased workload, risk of transmission, personnel shortage, and lack of resources are just a few of the things that has been affecting the physical and mental health of healthcare workers.
We just have to keep following, you know, whatever best guidelines are now out there. It is a learning process for everybody, but wear a mask, you know, wash your hands, the typical, you know, virus spreading precautions, because everyone wants this to go away, obviously.
Stick together and help people out, because I guess it can be a tough time emotionally too.
Doctors are emphasizing how important it is to stay healthy and smart. For the University of Delaware News, I'm Alexa Corfine.
Thanks to UD Senior Communications Major Alexa Corfine, as well as her classmates, Senior Kayla Williams and Junior Anthony Dolphin, for enlightening us this week with their features reporting on the pandemic from a student's perspective. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, University of Delaware student journalists Anthony Dolphin, Alexa Corfine, and Kayla Williams, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bird saying thanks for joining us this week. We'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.